Welcome, everybody. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. And this reading is based on the passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Again, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. And our speaker tonight, Thomas, is one of three disc golfers in the room. I hope to get him on the course soon. But in the meantime, we're going to hear his story. Thanks for coming, Thomas. We appreciate you.
Hey, everybody. My name is Thomas Van Beck, and I'm an alcoholic. I first want to thank everybody for coming out. I know that sometimes for me, getting to a meeting is difficult because of that four-letter word time, and I'll get into that a little bit later. My sobriety date is June 28th, 2018. The last go-around, I'd had 3 years before that, and I did what, you know, everybody says is happens if you make a mistake, is I stopped doing what I was supposed to be doing, which is go to meetings and stay active in the program. I kind of got wind of thinking that I could do it by myself, and that's never really worked out that well. So I was born in Iowa to a funeral director and a little Italian woman from Boston. So I was raised in a funeral home my whole life. So you guys can imagine, you know, hey, that line, man, at least it didn't kill you. I took that to a completely different realm because since I was 18, I was always around, you know, death and mourning. And so I always had in the back of my head, my card was, well, it's really not that bad. Okay. Unfortunately, the people that love me and care about me didn't have that same card. I didn't realize, and I'll go kind of into when I started my drinking and everything like that after I kind of go into, you know, my mom left me when I was about three. So trusting and stuff, especially with women in relationships, was always a very difficult thing. And I think it's difficult for everybody, you know, but it, for some reason, it just seemed like I didn't understand it, you know. And if I have something I don't understand, my problem is I try to go right to it and understand it. And, you know, there was, you know, a time I needed to accept the fact that I probably won't receive the apology that I'm looking for from that person. And through the program, I learned all this stuff, which is, you know, learning to accept that you're never going to get an apology from somebody ever again, or, you know, trying to understand why people did stuff. And, you know, I couldn't get it. So, you know, I think that, you know, when you go through all this stuff, maybe that was bearing all this other stuff. And I tried to meet her when I was 21, but that's not real life is not lifetime movies. You know, it's like I thought it was going to be this white light, and it just was, it was terrible. So when my dad remarried, I can remember that's when I kind of got a feeling like, you know, alcohol doesn't seem to be like a good thing. You know, there'd be times where he wouldn't come home, and I'd be like, what the hell? Why isn't my dad coming home? Or there'd be times I'd go outside and the car was wrecked. And I'd be like, what, you know, what's going on? And so I remember when I was living in New York for a while, I promised myself there's no way in the world, I'm ever going to become somebody like that, that drinks like that, that has problems and everything like that. So when we moved to Cincinnati from New York and I got into high school, I drank for the first time. I was 16, and I know a lot of people say, like, at least when I hear speakers say, like, when they were growing up, that they always felt kind of off or out of place or everything. I never had that feeling when I was growing up. I always felt like part of the, you know, I always felt part of things, and I never was really that shy, and I just kind of felt, you know, and I don't know if that was because I was raised in a funeral home, and I'm like, hey, guys, don't worry, you know, let's live it up right now. This is not that bad, but I just never really felt that way. And then I remember when I drank, I guess maybe, you know, it made me think to myself, you know, I was funny and I was attractive. And more importantly, if you didn't find me funny and attractive, I didn't care. It didn't make a difference, you know. And that night I blacked out. And you know, when you're at 16, it's kind of hard to get a hold of alcohol. So there were some other things, of course, in my life that I gravitated towards. But I guess, you know, now that I think about it, from... I guess, you know, since I saw my dad in his devastation with what was going on, and, you know, that's his thing. I can't say that that's what he is or anything like that, but sure enough, that's, I could see a telltale sign that there are some problems here and everything like that. And so, after that, like when I was about, I'd say 17 or 18 is when I got my first DUI. And so, I just always thought as a kid, and I think that probably, God bless my dad's heart, him raising me, was in order for me to get over the fact that my mom left, he made me, everything's okay, you know, there's not problems, here's this, and you get anything you want, and everything like that. And so I never really knew, I always kind of thought that everything was just a big party, and everything's always going to be okay, all the time, no matter what, and blah, blah, blah. And so it was difficult for me to make the transition to the point of, okay, you're in jail, you know, for this. And I thought to myself, well, we'll just chalk that up with just partying. You know, you get a DUI, you drink, driving, you're young. I'm young, I'm 16. And so, you know, then they do the evaluation, everything like that. And, you know, when you're 16 years old, you don't take in your own, you know, thing. It's just, I thought I was young. It was time to, you know, I didn't want to have any responsibilities. And then when I was 18, I got my second DUI. And even then, I didn't even take that into consideration. And so the point of me caring about anything, I think that even when I was sober and I wasn't actively, when it got real bad in my 30s, I just think that I was kind of already kind of molded to not care that much. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to die, you know, I'm only 16, you know, it's time to party all the time. And so then, you know, I was able to skate through high school. I don't even know how that happened. And, but it's like there was drugs involved, but that wasn't really what was going on. Now that I think about it, there's always alcohol all around, all the time, everywhere I went. There was always alcohol. I always was able to get my hands on it. And so, responsibility-wise and everything like that, I think I skated through and skinned through a lot of stuff. And so, when I finally had to go to drug court when I was 19, I was able to finally finish something. And I don't know how that happened, but I was able to get by it. Now, granted, the counselor and everything like that probably kind of skewed away some drug tests and things like that. I don't know how, because there's a bunch of them that I failed. But I never really took into consideration wanting to stop because, you know, to be honest with everybody, I know that maybe some people don't like to hear this, but when I drank, I really had a lot of fun for a little bit, you know, until it completely turned its back on me and it got really, really bad. So I would say probably around when I'm 21, when I finally got to the age of, you know, being able to drink whenever I wanted, whatever I wanted, I was, you know, going out every day basically in the week and just partying all the time. I didn't have a job. You know, my parents were just giving me money, which eventually just ended up being just a terrible, terrible idea. But that's just the way that it went. But even when the law said, hey, listen, you know, this isn't really working out. And my parents were like, hey, listen, this isn't really working out. And my drug counselor was like, hey, listen, this isn't really working out. And everybody around me is going, hey, man, don't you think maybe you ought to not drive home tonight? Ah, the hell with all that. It doesn't matter. Whatever. And so, you know, the point that I got to of where I knew that I was being self-destructive, and I always had it in me, was probably I was coming back from a Reds game and I'd wrecked my car, and the guy that was with me, you know, was like, you need to just start running. And I'm like, you know, and his face was all bleeding, everything like that. And I should have just stayed there, but sure enough, I ran off because I didn't want to get in trouble. You know, and You know, when my dad remarried and then they got split up again, my dad asked me if I wanted to move out with him and I could stay with my stepmom, who she couldn't have children. I knew in the bottom of my heart that if I went with my dad, I wouldn't be able to get away with the things that I could get away with a woman that wouldn't be able to have a kid, and I could be her kid. I knew that then. That's how despicable. And it wasn't even just because I knew that I wanted to get messed up. It was because I knew I could get away with a lot more shit. And that type of orneriness, that type of almost halfway deceiving evil that I didn't think twice of, you know, and so this woman who is my stepmom, who still is who I consider my mom because she left, the thought that I could do that, and, you know, that was the overall plan, it's pretty bad. I mean, that's a pretty bad way to treat other people and not even think twice about it, you know what I mean? And not even think twice about this human being who now is, geez, if it wasn't for her, I guarantee you I would have been dead, you know? It would be a good funeral, but I would have been dead. And so I remember there would be times where she'd catch me on the phone and I'd be talking about this and that, and she'd come downstairs and she'd try to talk to me, and I just knew deep down inside there's no way that she's going to get rid of me. She can't. There's too much invested in this right now with the love and everything like that, that there's just no way that we can do that. And that's that conniving, alcoholic behavior, even when you're not drinking. Okay, that's when, like, when I talk to my girlfriend, she's like, well, that's, you know, that's because we're alcoholics. I'm like, no, everybody does that. She's like, no, everybody doesn't do that. You know, there's a fine line where people do that. I mean, they're either psychopaths or you got to go to a meeting. You know, and so I always kind of felt bad about that. But when I moved out on my own and I was in my mid-20s and everything like that, and I started to really go out and drink a lot more. And so, like, I was living in Cincinnati and I was not paying any of my bills because I didn't know how to do that, because all I did my whole life was just get money given to me, and then I would go do whatever I want. I'd go to the call and I'd do the emergency call. Oh my God, my power is about to get shut off. All right, here's some more. It was just this vicious cycle of you know, what can happen if you just try to give somebody something, and the love is basically with numbers of money and everything like that. And so I didn't know how to do it. So my only out is you meet a girl, all right? They're very healthy, you know? And so I would meet a girl, and then we'd get together, and then I'd be, you know, like, well, why don't we move in together? And so I would just jumping around. So I moved from Cincinnati to Pittsburgh, and I moved in with this girl who I met at the mall, and it gets better. And we moved to Pittsburgh after knowing each other for about 4 months because I was not allowed to live in my apartment anymore. And she's like, well, I've always wanted to move back to Pittsburgh in my parents' house. And I'm going, that's a hell of an idea. I mean, because I'm getting this guy's rents coming after me, and I'm going, I got to get out of here. So we moved to Pittsburgh. And so I moved to Pittsburgh over love. Those four-letter words, we'll get into those in a little bit. And, of course, it didn't work out because that's when I knew. I was about 31. That's when I knew, I think I have a problem. But I didn't want to do anything about it. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that I've always been like that since my dad said I was young. I've always been what he calls a free spirit, which is basically, if I don't want to do something, I'm not going to do it. That it was so hard for me to find a job and stick with a job and pay with my own bills because I wasn't used to doing it. And if I didn't want to do it, I wasn't going to do it. It didn't matter what the consequences was. And so that's the thing about, you know, and I'll kind of sidetrack about with AA is when I realized that when people say you have to want it, that's a four-letter word that you guys should probably all think about. You know, I always thought four-letter words meant curse words, you know, like shit, you know, or the F word or something like that. But there's so many other words like love and hate, you know, powerful words. And the other thing is want. You know, I didn't want to stop drinking, even after all this stuff. I moved to Pittsburgh, and that's when I realized the problems. And so I'm going, how am I going to get myself out of this one? So I call my dad. My dad's living in Texas. And I say, Dad, you know, I moved up here, it was a mistake. And my dad's going, oh my gosh, you know, we never had this time when your dad, your mom and me got the first or the second divorce and you went with her. Now you can come down here and spend time with me. And my dad was drinking very heavily at the time. And that's when things started to turn very, very dark. And I realized that this is a very powerful thing that basically, now that I realize what it wants to do after it got a lot worse, is get me alone by myself in a hotel room down in Decatur and kill me. That's what it wants to do. It doesn't want anybody around. And I don't like, you know, I like people, but I'm not really that much of a humanitarian as it is. And so my dad comes up and with the rescue ship and rescues me and brings me back down to Texas, and I move in with him, and we're both actively drinking very heavily. And that, and we get together, and I live with him for a little bit of time, and it was just hell. It turned out, at first it was really nice, but then it turned violent. You know, the father son shootout. You know, I just blah 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 and everything like that, and so then it was the first time that I've ever seen my dad be violent, because we're in the kitchen and we're both drunk, and I don't know what it is with me, but and I'm nothing, you know, I can't beat anybody's ass, and my dad's like 6'4", and I'm just screaming at him in the kitchen. I don't even know how we got there, and I'm just sitting there just screaming at him, asking him to punch me, you know, like, because I had that, I thought he wouldn't do it. But sure shit, he clocked me right in the face. And you know how somebody hits you not ready? Like, wait. That's what happened. I didn't know what happened because I didn't think he was going to do it. And after I saw him do that, and the look on his face was, I don't even know what you are. I don't even know what I've created, but now it's coming into my life. And the look on his face was so scary that he just turned around and went in his room and went to sleep. And so I knew then that then he was moving to Atlanta. And then 2 days before, because I was going to come with him to Atlanta, 2 days before I leave to come to Atlanta, I meet a girl. Right? And here we go. Here we go, because it worked before. So I know this girl for 72 hours. I moved to Atlanta with my dad. I'm here for 2 months. I know this girl for 72 hours, guys. Pack up all my shit, move back to Atlanta, or move back to Houston, and move in with her. She's still married. Yeah, it just keeps getting better. So I move in with her. I'm begging her to get a divorce because I earned it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I bring my alcoholism into her life. And as you guys can tell, I mean, actually, it's surprisingly that worked out for about 2 or 3 years. She put up with me for about 2 or 3 years and moving and everything like that. And it never turned violent or anything like that. But it didn't. I mean, we moved down to Montrose after living out there. And then one day I tried to kiss one of her friends. And she's like, listen, Thomas, she's like, I love you. You're the love of my life. But your alcohol and the way that you act and everything like that, I can't do this. And I'm sitting there thinking in the back of my head, what's the big deal? Because it was always like that with the way I was growing up. If me and my dad ever got in a fight the next day, even if we remembered or not, it was like this. Hey, listen, I'm sorry about last night. No big deal. We'll just move on. And I remember my dad came in for Christmas one day down in Houston, and me and him got into a fight. We were down at the symphony, and Debbie, the girl that I moved to Houston with, and he came knocking on the door the next morning, and he goes, hey, how's it going? I go, good. And I'm like, I'm sorry about last night. He's like, don't worry about it. And she looked at me, she goes, that's how it works in your family? You guys just say you're sorry and just move on? And I'm going, well, isn't that the way it's supposed to go? And she's like, no, it's not. You have to pay some sort of consequence. You can't just go, yeah, I messed up, and keep it moving. I mean, maybe once or twice, but geez, over and over again. I remember it got to the point, I'm sure as everybody's been in this realm, where you wake up in the morning, all right, and you're with somebody, and you just don't even say anything to them. You just immediately jump into, I'm sorry. You don't even ask them what happened. And then it's like, well, it wasn't that bad, Thomas. And I'm going, oh, okay. You know, I didn't jump anybody or slap anybody or tell anybody anything wrong. It was a good night. And so I'm going, what am I doing? I'm playing with lottery with my nights. Was it a good night? Yeah, no, it wasn't very good. You don't remember what you said? No, I don't. And people have this phenomenon about them that aren't alcoholics about what a blackout is. I don't remember. Okay? I don't remember what happened. So then we got down to the nitty-gritty. So I call my dad. My dad's remarried. Okay? He lives in Atlanta. And he's like, okay, you're going to come back to Atlanta. Can you make it here by yourself? Okay? Can you get up, not drink, and not, or don't drink too much, and get in your car and drive to Atlanta? Guess what? Couldn't do it. Couldn't make it. Tried for like a week. I couldn't do it. I'd get up, I'd get too drunk, and I knew I wouldn't be able to make it. So he decides to fly in. Okay? I tell him I'll go pick him up at the airport. Okay? Guess what? No Thomas. All right? For some reason, I don't know how he found out. He found out where I was living. He comes to my apartment, and he knocks on my door, and he's like, what's going on? And I'm like, I'm at this point, I'm day drinking during the day all day. You know, like you go to sleep, you wake up, you know, you just drink, and that's it. And I don't remember anything. So I'm sitting there going, well, if I sleep it off, well, yeah, but if you've been drinking for the past 3 weeks, you don't sleep it off. It's already in your system so long. And so finally they're like, okay, we're going to get you up to Atlanta. So they have somebody fly down, drive me and my car up. Of course, I can't make it up here because the guys, my friend's like, we're not buying anything to drink. And I'm like, well, then you're not driving my car. You know, that's the kind of pissant I was. That's what my grandma used to call it, just a pissant. Just, you got everybody trying to help you, you're not doing anything for yourself. And then you got attitude with it. You know what I mean? Like, you got something. Like, this isn't your car anyway. So we get here. They check me into a place called, I can't remember what it's called. It's like a, I can't remember. I don't want to waste anybody's time with me not remembering stuff. And so I get there, and that's going along pretty well for about a month. And it wasn't inpatient or anything. I could still go do whatever I want. But it wasn't like some of the halfway houses that you guys hear about where there's, you know, like 13 people living in a 3-bedroom apartment. And like, it was pretty nice, you know, and it cost a pretty good amount of money. And I met somebody, the first job I got, I met somebody that said, I need somebody to move into my house. Can you do it? I'm going, sure I can. Out the door. Any way I could just to get a drink. Just a drink. So I moved out, moved in with them. Within a week, I lost the job I met the guy at. They kicked me out. They asked me to leave. I went back to the other place again. And then about 2 weeks into that, I drank again. And we could go through all these all night long. I mean, in and out, over, around, all this other stuff, blah, blah, blah. The clincher was I was not in a program. I was living with my mom keeps calling me up and saying, Thomas, hey, listen, we're trying to get in touch with you. We don't even know where you're at. You know, the school in Houston that you went to, I went to culinary school in Houston, graduated, surprisingly, and they're like, there's a check that's coming, but nobody knows where to send it. And I'm like, whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I called the school, and I'm like, so, you know, here you have a check. I guess they got audited. And I was like, well, how much is the check for? And they said, the check's for $8,000. And I said, here we fucking go. And I knew what was going to happen. So I met my dad. Now, I'm not trying to pass the buck, but I knew then what was wrong. And I knew if I got my hands on that money, you probably wouldn't see me maybe ever again. And it almost happened. And if you guys are in here, anybody's new, and I don't think anybody is, but if there is anybody that's new and don't think that this is trouble or fatal, let me tell you the story. I got the $8,000. I met my dad at the gas station. I saw him. I said, listen, I got the check coming to you, and I want you to put it in your bank, and I want you to talk to me about what we can do to, you know, maybe get this, because I'm still actively drinking, and, you know, I probably weigh like 130 pounds, and before I left, I remember my dad's like, Thomas, you need to eat something. And I'm like, all right, blah, blah, blah. So the check comes, and my dad goes, this isn't my money, this is your money. So I go to Chase in Decatur, I open up an account, I drop that money in there, it's available the next week. I check myself into the Masters in Decatur right there off 285, okay? And I stay there for 33 days, okay, by myself, drinking and going to the mall and buying Jordans. That's all I did. wake up, drink, maybe get enough courage to go out, but I wasn't eating anything or anything like that. And so then my friend who I was seeing at the time, she came over and she starts looking, because one time I remember I ran out of money and I was going to go stay with my dad, and I tried to get up to go to the bathroom, and I hadn't drank for about 8 to 12 hours. And so, you're in a hotel, the bathroom is from here to maybe over there. Well, I couldn't make it. I was off. There was something wrong. My balance was off. My muscles felt off. I was going through massive withdrawals. So she looked on her computer, and she's saying that there's, this is a problem. And so I went to my dad's house, and within about 6 hours, I'm sitting there and I'm reading about it. And I'm watching TV, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this guy in the stand in the doorway, and I'm like, when I look over, he disappears. And so I'm like, okay, so I knew this was going to happen. It's not that big of a deal, but it was so real. It was so real. And so sure enough, I'm sitting there, I'm watching TV again. I look over, and there he is again. And I look over there, and he disappears again. So I'm watching TV, and then it gets worse. There's him, and there's like a little girl sitting in between his legs looking at me, and they're all just staring at me. And so, like, within about 3 hours, there's about 12, 13 people. And so I think there's ghosts in the house at this point, because my reasoning's out the door. I go downstairs, I tell my dad. They take me to Newport. I don't know if you guys ever heard of that place. And I have two seizures there. They take me to Grady, to the ICU, and that night I stopped breathing. Okay, so that night I stopped breathing. They put me on a breathing machine. I was in the ICU for 2 weeks, and I don't remember any of it. I was able to talk to the people that let me out to give me a prescription for Ativan. I went and got the prescription for Ativan. That day I got out, and I went to the liquor store, and I got a pint of liquor, and I started drinking again. After all that, I mean, it almost makes you cry, because it's just like insane, like what the hell? And I'm going, well, didn't kill you. And that was, I was running out of chips, because it was starting to kill me, because there's only so much that you're going to be able to take of that, But sure enough, I kept doing that. I kept doing that over and over and over and over again until I went to a place that's down the street, and it's a halfway house. And I went there a few times, got kicked out of there, and I know we're kind of running short on time, so I decided to become their van driver, which sounds like a horrible job, but I needed to do it because it just put me in my spot. It gave me a responsibility. It was simple. There wasn't a lot of money. I couldn't get in a lot of trouble. I still had the freedom to drive if I wanted to, kind of. And I started, and I saw people coming in. I'd pick up people and coming out and everything like that. So I got a chance to be involved. And it's so, it's basic stuff. If you look at a lot of basic experiences, I don't want to say religions, it just belief systems is community. Be honest. Tell on yourself. Be part of the, problem. Admit when you're wrong. Those kind of things are all kind of incorporated here. And I started coming to this meeting every morning, at 11 o'clock. And even my director's like, you don't need to be going to that meeting at 11 o'clock. I'm like, wait, what? This is, So I started coming here, and that's when I realized that, I woke up and I was like, you know what? One day I woke up and I just thought to myself, you know what? And I'm going to do it today. And then I just kept on doing that. And I got stronger and stronger. And then I got a job and I didn't go to my meetings and I relapsed. But I'd gotten it. You know what I mean? I wasn't in that I didn't believe it phase anymore. I knew there was something wrong and I knew that I could get out of it. And I knew coming here would help. And it's been difficult, and it's taught me so much, and I realize that, if I didn't have it in my life at this point, realizing that the drinking thing is kind of something that I'm going to have to walk with for the rest of my life. Okay? It's something I'm gonna have to walk right beside forever. And it just makes it easier to realize that I don't have to beat it. The only way to win is not to play. You know what I mean? And don't try to do, for me, I wasn't try that because, one day I woke up and I was smart and I wanted to change the world. And then one day I woke up and I was wise and I wanted to change myself. So that's all I got. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Well done. Really appreciate it. And we appreciate you.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand and try and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its day and the lessons fall of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.